The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another live recording of Trump's Trials and Tribulations, New York Trial Dispatch Edition. Today is May 7th, 2024, and I'm Roger Parloff, a senior editor at Lawfare. I'm here with managing editor Tyler McBrien, editor-in-chief Benjamin Wittes, and special guest, Claire Manial, the U.S. correspondent of Le Point, the French political weekly and website. Because we had a particularly noteworthy witness today, we're going to turbo right to that person's testimony. Tyler, you were in the courtroom. Who was the witness number two today? And what were the highlights of his or her testimony, and how did he or she do?
Well, I'm going to dispense with the suspense right away. Her name is Stormy Daniels, a.k.a. Stephanie Cliffords, and a.k.a. Peggy Peterson on one of the agreements. And it was a dramatic day, to be honest. We first heard, of course, from the prosecution, which questioned her, starting basically with her biography from her childhood, which was, you know, not the easiest childhoods. She excelled in school, but was unable to go to college on a scholarship, even as she said. But then we quickly turned to, you know, when she met Donald Trump, which was in 2006, I believe, at a celebrity golf tournament in Lake Tahoe, if I'm not mistaken. And this is where the story got interesting. She had met him then. This, of course, led to the sexual encounter. And, you know, early on, she was giving quite a bit of detail. I think perhaps you could say too much detail, more so than the judge wanted, more so than the prosecution wanted. There were quite a few objections being launched from the defense, which were sustained by the judge. There were quite a few sidebars. And I think Ben can speak to this better. I think this started to annoy Justice Merchan and the defense, which led to a mistrial motion, which we can get to later. But as the prosecution laid it out, you know, I think they really tried to get ahead of, you know, a few of the defense's attacks on her. So attacking her credibility that she was an extortionist, that she was money motivated. They tried to paint her as, you know, someone who actually was quite comfortable monetarily. She did well in her career. She was direct. She was not only, you know, starring in films, she was directing them. She was directing music videos. She had an equestrian sort of career as well as a horse owner. They were trying to portray her as someone not motivated by money and therefore, you know, someone who wouldn't go out of their way to threaten and extort Donald Trump. But I think the most emotional or tense part of the direct was when she was describing the actual sexual encounter itself with Donald Trump, which was, I would say, you could perhaps frame it as sexual assault or even rape. Even though she was, she did point out that she didn't feel threatened she was not threatened physically or emotionally, and that she was not under the influence of drugs or alcohol of any kind. But still, it was not a comfortable, you know, retelling. And she said she felt a lot of shame. Her hands were shaking afterwards. And it was quite a difficult experience for her.
She said she blacked out at some point.
That's right. Yeah. So she said she blacked out, not again from any sort of stimulants or drugs or alcohol, but because it was such a traumatic experience. She said that you know, things were happening in slow motion. The room was spinning. She kept saying to herself, how did I get into this situation? And this was the sexual encounter she was describing in the hotel suite of Donald Trump's. Afterwards, again, she didn't tell anyone out of, she said, shame. except for a few close confidants. I'll leave it there for the prosecution. And that brings us up to a break. And I don't know if Ben, you want to add anything, or Claire, you want to add anything up to that point?
Yeah, Claire, why don't you tell us your perspective on this witness during the, all through it. Was this a credible witness?
Yeah, first of all, I was really glad that I had read the book, because I thought the whole story was really confusing. And even if you read the book, the dates are not really there. You need sometimes to go a few pages. You know, you need to really search in the book to kind of understand what things are happening. So I was really wondering how the jury would understand when the encounter happened. And then you have all those things about her childhood. I don't know. At some point, they tried to introduce this. You know, they asked her, did Mr. Trump ask you about your childhood, that it was a difficult one, and there was an objection? And I think they might have wanted to get to the point at which she was raped as a child. I don't know. What did you guys think? Because when she was nine, she was raped for a year by a neighbor. She has this sentence, which is, I was a child until I wasn't. I think she's a very moving character. But I thought also it was difficult to follow. And I was trying to put myself in the shoes of a jury who hasn't read the book, who just knew the big headlines, and who would be like, wait a minute, and trying to figure out when everything happened.
If you were following, you know, my live tweets or others, there are quite a few times when both Assistant DA Hoffinger, as well as the judge, as well as the court reporter, asked Daniels to slow down or repeat herself, because she was talking quite fast. And you might interpret that as nervousness, but I personally didn't really sense a nervousness. I think that's how she talks. And other people who have listened to her podcast have told me that she talks quite fast. And I don't know, she struck me as in control rather than nervous. And this was just sort of, this is her affectation. So more context for that.
So Ben, you were a Stormy Daniels skeptic. You didn't see a need to call her at all, at least before this. What are your thoughts today?
Well, so just to be clear, my skepticism was about bringing her as a witness, not about her as a person. I think she's, you know, everything that Claire and Tyler just said, I don't dissent from any of it. My skepticism of her as a witness was extreme, down to the point that this morning when we were standing in the press line, I was saying to almost anybody who listened that she would not be called as a witness, because she actually cannot speak to the elements of the offense. The elements of the offense being falsifying a business record with intent to cover up or commit some other crime, right? And she is not the predicate or object offense, but the object, without objectifying her, I think we can say she, the conduct with Stormy Daniels is the subject of the object offense, right? So it's like one step removed from that. And she's an extremely problematic witness who arguably has engaged in something akin to extortion, whether fairly or not, that's, you know, what we could reasonably expect the defense to try to argue. She's changed her story a lot. She's behaved in a quite mercenary fashion, and she has outstanding debts to Donald Trump of some $500,000, which she has sworn to go to jail rather than to pay. And so I thought, hey, no reasonable prosecutor, you can prove this case without her. And in fact, all her testimony doesn't really materially add very much to proof beyond a reasonable doubt on the elements of the actual crime. So I just thought, well, they wouldn't actually call her. And they did. And I think it's working out extremely badly for them.
For the prosecution.
Yes. And so let me just flesh that out a little bit. What did they get for calling Stormy Daniels? Well, they got, and Tyler and I were kind of talking about this at lunch, I think what they get is a series of statements that, by the way, seem quite credible, and I don't think the defense is going to be able to puncture that in whatever interactions he had with Stormy Daniels, he did not express any concern for her keeping it secret. he did not express any concern for Melania or for his kids or for, right? So he simply wanted whatever sex he got from her and was completely unashamed and unconcerned about privacy of it until such time as there were electoral consequences, at which point he, you know, paid up. And that's a, you know, that's a little a significant bit of evidence, though, in my opinion, cumulative, that he actually didn't give a shit about this until the election. Right. So they got that. And then the second thing they got was, and very much in the same way, that if Trump is the core of the defense here is that this is what's a poor, innocent presidential candidate to do when he's suddenly subject to extortionate demands by porn stars. Of course, he pays up like anybody does. And of course, just as you would as a husband and as a man and as a father, you know, of course you pay up and falsify the business records. Come on, right? That's kind of part of the defense here. And by creating a, I mean, it's not a rape allegation, but it's a rape adjacent allegation. And, you know, he does not sound anything like an innocent extortion victim who's, you know, so that's what they got. And what they're paying for it now in is there, we've had a couple hours already, and we're going to have hours and hours tomorrow of cross-examination in which she looks like an extortionate, lying, money-grubbing, sometimes crazy person who contradicts herself constantly and is, you know, trying to sell to one magazine that the story happened and to another magazine that the story didn't happen kind of at the same time. And she's, no pun intended, in bed with some super creepy people like Keith Davidson and Gina Rodriguez, who are definitely in the extortion business.
Michael Avenatti, right?
Yeah, and Michael Avenatti.
Claire, you wanted to say something in there.
Yes. I was wondering for Tyler, you were in a courtroom. What's the balance between men and women among the jury? I don't know if you remember, Ben, but so she has this 3-hour conversation with Trump in the suite. She said 2 hours today, but in the book she said 3 hours. And then she goes to the bathroom, and when she's out, he's in his boxer shorts and t-shirt on the bed, clearly expecting sex. And she has this thought, and she says, how did I misread the situation so much? And I don't know if you remember, but in the overflow room, men from the public laughed. And I looked at the women, they were really not laughing, because that's really something that will happen to a lot of women. And I was not laughing at all. I was like, how would anyone laugh? And I thought, well, that has to play a role in the jury. There will be some women who will be sympathetic, but there might also be men who will be like, well, what did you expect? That's a conversation I've actually had with other reporters, men who cover this trial, and who told me, you know, you go up to a guy's suite, what do you think is going to happen? And I was trying to explain sometimes the difficult dynamic, and I was thinking there will be an element here how men and women see this case differently and what credibility they give to Stormy Daniels, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. As for the makeup of the jury, it's fairly mixed in terms of gender. And the reaction at that exact point that you're mentioning, it could be, you know, I could attribute this maybe to the stricter court rules in the actual courtroom. There were no audible reactions that I could hear, especially when Stormy Daniels is recounting the actual encounter. It was dead silent and it was quite uncomfortable. I couldn't discern actually much from the jury's reactions. They were very attentive. They were taking copious notes, it looked like. They were going back and forth between question and answerer, questioner and answerer. But no, I couldn't tell. There was actually one woman. I wasn't sure her role for the court. She was seated next to Justice Merchant's bench. She was not a court reporter. I think she was perhaps an aide of some sort. During this whole interaction, though, or this whole, you know, retelling, she had her hand over her mouth almost as if in horror, because it was horrible, I think, you know, what she was saying.
Right. And again, I don't mean to detract from any of that, sure, because it's super important. But, you know, I do keep coming back to, this is a crime, alleged crime, about falsification of business records. And the way we get to this interaction in 2007, in this case, is Trump is alleged to have falsified business records to cover up the fact that he reimbursed Michael Cohen for paying off Stormy Daniels for keeping quiet about a story in 2016, of which this was the sort of core, right? So it's many, many layers of attenuation. And I think, you know, this gets to the judge's irritation, which was acute, by the way. Justice Merchan has been very protective of Trump's rights, notwithstanding the way Trump talks about him. But on key things, he has often ruled with the prosecution, although on some key things, he's ruled with the defense. Here, he was quite solicitous of the defense's sense that this was salacious and irrelevant to the actual charged crime. And he was very keen to police the ability of the prosecution to get aspects of the story that, you know, from a sort of cultural feminist perspective, you really want to be central here. And he wants them to be very clipped and very marginal. And that's not because he's, you know, an anti-feminist. It's because he's a judge in a case that's supposed to be about falsification of business records. And he actually chided. So in the middle of the day, the defense turns around and asks for a mistrial on the basis that way too much of this stuff has gotten in. And he turns around and is quite, I thought, sort of bitter toward the defense and says, look, you know, I granted most of the objections. I sustained most of the objections you guys lodged. And, you know, Jesus Christ, I had to do some of them sua sponte because you guys aren't even objecting. And so I think there was a sort of frustration on the judge's part with the prosecution for putting him in this position, but then on the defense's part for actually not making enough of it. And so I think it's a really ethically and morally and legally complicated little situation that arose today. And I'm not sure anybody came out of it looking good, including Justice Merchan, who clearly had some portion of the day get out of control for him.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Let me push back a little bit on the legal issue. I mean, because it's not just about falsification of records. It's about influencing an election by illegal means. And so in that respect, it would be important to me as a juror to know that this thing really happened, that she's not lying, because if it didn't happen and he suppresses something that didn't happen, it's hard for me to say, well, that influenced the election. And then also what he's suppressing matters, because would it have affected anything And then you see the way what she was saying is pretty powerful stuff that might have affected something. So I think there's a there. What do you say about that?
Well, so I agree. I mean, I'm not saying she should have been kept off the stand by the judge, right? I'm not saying his rulings on the motions in limine were wrong.
Right.
I'm saying if I'm Coangelo and Joshua Steinglass and Jay Bratt's team, I don't know that the evidentiary value of her testimony is worth the beating that they are taking both from the defense and from the judge. And it might be, and you won't know until you poll the jurors afterwards and say, hey, what do you think of Stormy Daniels? How did she sway you? But I'm anxious about it.
Yeah.
I'll just say one more thing. And in bringing in what Hoffinger said at the actual hearing for the motion for mistrial, she said that Stormy Daniels' account is, quote, highly probative of Trump's intent, which is the element. And it's also, she points out, as you said, Ben, it's what he was attempting to hide, but also when. So as we talked about earlier, there were several points at first in Daniels' testimony and rather in Hoffinger's questions where she was asking Daniels about these meetings that seemed insignificant, actually, after the actual sexual encounter. So there was one at a vodka event where Trump saw her very briefly. There was another at his bungalow, which seemed nefarious at first, but it was also very brief. It was always, he made advances. So I should backtrack there. But it was always under the pretense, and once in Trump Tower, which was also very brief, under the pretense of The Apprentice. But I realized that she was asking the same questions every time. The questions were, did at that point he ask you to keep the encounter confidential? Did he seem worried about people knowing? Did his wife know about this? And it was always no. And so until you get to the Access Hollywood tape, which is just right on the doorstep of the election, which all of a sudden is when it became important to him. So I think that speaks to the underlying object defense. And it also, I think, as you were saying, deflates this the defense that Trump is some extortionist victim when, prior to the election, he didn't actually care about the story getting out that much.
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, let's go back to that mistrial motion, because I'm aware of mainly from your tweets that there were some pretty disturbing things that came in. There was the threat in the garage, alleged threat to Stormy Daniels by somebody. We don't know who. There was Stormy blacking out during the encounter. There was Trump not wearing a condom and that concerning her. There was Trump saying something about this was sort of offering her a way out of the trailer park. These were some pretty emotional things. Ben, do you think these are points on appeal? How bad was it?
So obviously this is a matter on which the judge has a lot of discretion. You can write a hell of an appellate brief on the basis of this record. And it would take more than I know about New York state appellate criminal law to offer a prediction about that. But I have seen nothing until today that gives rise to, I think, even a colorable appeal in the event of a conviction. I could write the appellate brief based on today's events. And that's part of the reason that I feel a little bit like, I'm sorry, why did you put her on the stand? Like, what did you gain by doing this that's so important that you're...
Yeah.
And look, the answer may be, the press coverage today is, saturation, Stormy Daniels. And by the way, a whole lot of women feel very vindicated by this testimony because it's experience that a lot of people have. And I don't want to diminish any of that. I do want to say that from a protection of your conviction point of view, this was not a good day for the prosecution.
Can I ask Claire briefly what you made of the 2011 threat in the parking lot, especially having read the book? To me, it struck me as a bit strange. I don't know. It seemed like a bit of a digression or I just didn't know what to make of it. I was wondering if you had any thoughts.
Well, I think it's important to explain why she was then afraid for her life. And she also explains, remember in the book at some point, that she has a friend who was a lawyer and who in 2016 said, hey, this is not the Republican candidate. This is a completely new game. You know that they get rid of people who are bad to them. Even if they don't like Donald Trump, you know, the people they don't like disappear. And she really freaked out. And so I guess that's why the Vegas anecdote makes sense here. And also among the discrepancies between what she said today and the book, there is this very powerful sentence of, I thought you wanted to get out of the trailer park, which is, it's not in the book. And she says it hurt her, and it's a such a terrible sentence. And then this is the sentence that we talked about, Ben, when Gloria Allred, she says she wanted her to include that there was a rape in the encounter, which then she said didn't happen. And then that was also a pretty heavy thing just to drop in the cross. I don't know what you thought.
That came out today in some way?
So what she said that is that when she talked to Gloria Allred, who was a lawyer, and so in the book she says there was absolutely no sexual encounter. I just met Donald Trump and nothing happened. And then Gloria Allred says, well, then I can't help you, and hangs up. And today she says, yeah, no, I didn't want to do it because she wanted me to include sexual details that weren't true. And
specifically a sexual assault / rape kind of allegation.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that came up and that was also not in the book. And that's a completely different allegation. And then she started saying that the book was an abbreviated version of what happened to her. So this is a very serious doubt to cast.
And there's a lot of those. I mean, you know, so Susan Nicholas, who is doing the cross-examination here, has just adduced a lot of situations in which Stormy Daniels says one thing in one situation and another thing in another situation, and has made a fairly credible case that distinguishes between the two situations is where she perceives the money is. And like, that's not, you know, being a mercenary in the world of adult education and celebrity culture is not the worst sin in the world, but it does raise questions about your credibility as a witness. And she's going to deal with that. And I suspect they're going to be hours of that Thursday.
To your question about some of these, you listed a few of the very, you know, salacious or more dramatic things we heard, the trailer park comment, et cetera. Todd Blanche raised in the motion for mistrial hearing, he said several times, you can't unring that bell. You know, he sort of acknowledged and thanked Justice Merchan for sustaining objections where he did, defense objections where he did, and even, you know, objecting sua sponte when the defense wasn't objecting, but the jury still heard it. I think that's an important point that Blanche made.
Quickly, we had Susan Hoffinger for the prosecution and Susan Nicholas for the defense.
Yes, as Keith Davidson would say, everybody deferred to the estrogen mafia today in talking to Stormy Daniels. There were no male trial lawyers who interviewed her.
We also talked about three or four Keiths during the day.
And how did they do, Claire? What did you think?
So, you know, my first reaction when I saw who was sitting there, I was like, oh, okay, they're going to send in the women. And it made me think about the Amber Heard case, you know, with this confrontation of women. I was like, that is smart. But yeah, I thought Nicholas was really tough. Like, it was a tough questioning. And it has this very, the questions like, you're making this stuff right now as you're speaking to us, right? Those were really, really tough and aggressive questions. I thought that was remarkable.
And Tyler, same?
Same reaction. Susan Nicholas, I think every time she's gotten up to speak throughout the whole trial has been extremely impressive. But she was, you know, quite dogged today in a way that I don't think we've seen her yet. And I think Stormy Daniels was taken aback by quite a few of those questions.
I think we're almost out of time.
But I want to grab a note of a moment of personal privilege, asserting the editor-in-chief power, because it has come to my attention that, and I haven't verified this, that a shout out that Anna and I gave to a officer of the New York Court Police the other day may have fallen victim to our tech woes Thursday evening when we had some catastrophic sound problems. So I want to reiterate it just in case it was not heard by people on YouTube or heard by people on our podcast, that there is a gentleman, his name is Officer Zarate, who is responsible for what sounds like an easy job. And I just want to tell you all, it is not an easy job. It is managing the line of journalists getting into the actual courtroom. And we all have to go through two levels of security. And by the time people get up to the 15th floor and are going through the second level of security, there is a bottleneck that he is responsible for alleviating and for making sure people get through in a fast, non-mob-like fashion. And he has devised a particularly clever way of feeding people from multiple elevators through two magnetometers. And it's brilliant. And he's really popular among the press corps because he gets us in relatively quickly and very fairly. That's the other thing about it. It's super fair. And everybody knows how it's going to work. And so I just want to give a shout out to Officer Zarate in case this actually didn't get cut on Thursday and it's duplicative. He's earned a second shout out. But this is actually what rule of law enforcement looks like.
Well, we will leave it there then. Claire Manial of
LaPointe. Thank you so much.
Tyler McBrien, Ben Wittes, thank you all for joining us. And thank you all for watching. And if you want to support Lawfare's coverage of the Trump trials and watch this Dispatch Without Ads next time, become a Lawfare material supporter at lawfaremedia.org/support. See you on Thursday.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.